Friends, did you know that the temperature at night can have one of the biggest impacts on your sleep quality? If you often wake up too hot or too cold, I can definitely recommend Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. In addition to their self-cooling properties for better quality sleep, Miracle Made bedding has awesome self-cleaning properties so you can say goodbye to stale odors. And you'll get the luxurious, super comfortable feel we're all looking for without the ridiculously high price tag. I have to be honest with you guys, I truly love my white Miracle Made sheets. They are so clean, they are so crisp, and they prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. This leaves them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times as long than other sheets. Most other sheets, they're teeming with little allergy and acne-causing bacteria that you do not want in your bed. So, why don't you just listen to me and go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code thestacks at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it is backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code thestacks to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode and making my bedtime even better. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and it is our first episode of the brand new year, and I am so excited to kick off 2024 with Zach Stafford. Zach is a journalist. He is a contributor at MSNBC, the former editor-in-chief at The Advocate magazine. He hosts one of my very favorite podcasts, Vibe Check, along with friends of the show, Saeed Jones and Sam Sanders. Zach and I today get to talking about an alternate life he could have lived as a geography professor. We talk about the importance of place, his Tony Award for Strange Loop, and of course, the many, many books he loves, and the one classic that he and I both have absolutely never read. Zach will be back for the Stacks Book Club discussion of Erasure by Percival Everett on Wednesday, January 31st. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on today's episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. It is a new year, and if you're looking for ways to support your favorite creators, I would encourage you to support this podcast, The Stacks, over on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/thestacks, you can join the Stacks Pack. You earn perks like bonus episodes, inside access, our Discord channel. We're doing a brand new mega reading challenge this year. We're having a lot of fun. Plus, by joining the Stacks Pack, you make it possible for me to make this independent podcast every single week. So if that sounds like something you want to support in this new year, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join us. Shout out to our newest members, Dorothy, Harmony Coleman, Jay Jones, Melissa R. Green, and Stella Edozomwan Witt. Thank you all so much for joining the Stacks Pack, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. I'm very excited to start a whole nother year with all of you. All right, now it is time for my conversation with Zach Stafford. All right, everybody, you heard the real intro. Here is the fun intro. We have had Sam Sanders. We have had Saeed Jones. We have even had an episode of Vibe Check play on this very feed, but we have not had the Tony Award-winning editor, journalist, world's greatest human, Zach Stafford, on the Stacks until right this very minute. Zach, welcome to the Stacks.
Oh my God, thank you. That was I'm so full from that. Thank you. That was the warmest welcome I've ever gotten in my entire life. So thank you, Tracy.
Welcome.
It's so good to be here.
My audience has been harassing me. They're like, when is that coming on? I'm like, I hope soon so that you'll stop yelling at me. So everyone who has been waiting for Zach, here he is.
I'm here. And that's so nice because I have like all of us, imposter syndrome for everything. And I do a show every week called Vibe Check with two amazing people, Sam and Saeed. And when they told me about their experiences, because we met at a party, like we didn't know each other first, but we met through Sam at a party and Saeed had talked about you, but you were like this kind of mythological literary character in my life. And I thought only the greats came on the show. And I was like, well, I'm not a great. So it's Saeed Jones. Like, I don't compare.
You're a great.
And now I'm here. So thank you for having me.
You're a great.
And I'm so excited. Thank you.
I am Glinda the Good Witch and I anoint you, Zach the Great. Welcome to the podcast.
I love it here.
Good. We love you. For people who don't know you and for you to not talk about your professional resume, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, like where you're from, maybe a little bit about your relationship to books, but just sort of like, who's Zach Stafford?
Yeah. So Zach Stafford is, when I first became a writer professionally, my bio was Zach Stafford is a Tennessee writer living in Chicago. I now no longer live in Tennessee or Chicago. I live in Los Angeles, but those two places are really huge for me. And place has always been a huge part of my career and life. You know, growing up in the South, I was a book worm because I was the only Black kid in my class. I was the only gay kid in my class. And books were my place of refuge. So, you know, that's like reading, and that's why I'm so excited to be here, has shaped everything. And reading is what made me a better writer. Because when I got to college, I was a huge reader and lover of books, but my writing wasn't great. And so many of my like English lit professors and my modern language professors would make me write essays and read them aloud to them. And so anyway, and I got to meet so many writers and it really inspired me. So eventually, for my resume portion of this spiel, I became a journalist, surprisingly. I thought I was going to be a professor of geography, which is how much I love place. Yeah, I wanted to be a geographer. And I was really interested in all the beginning of my writing. People who've known me for a long time, the beginning of my writing was very much about Grindr and geolocative apps like Tinder and the emergence of a digital self on the internet and how we are existing simultaneously in a meat space and a cyberspace. And that like you, Tracy, have your digital self that currently is racking up bills on your Apple, you know, your Apple ID, you're right. Living on Twitter, people are engaging with you, but you're also sitting here with me talking about, you know, our lives. So there's a multiplicity of you in the world. So that was the beginning of my work, was I was very interested in writing about that.
Okay, wait, pause. Like, I have to ask.
Yeah.
I have to interrupt because I have to know. When you were interested in geography, were you interested in geography because of the online of it all? Or was that something that came to you later, like in your work? Because I know you worked at Grindr and you were sort of like in charge of that stuff. But when you were interested in geography, like growing up and even in college, were you thinking about geography in relationship to onlineness or not yet?
It began that way. So my first love of geography was the cartographic ways in which we think of maps. I thought maps were so interesting. Mm. I studied them voraciously in middle school. I won my school's geography bee. We had a geography bee my seventh grade year.
And what does that entail?
It's describing like countries. So it would say something like, okay, what is a country in Southeast Asia that is bordered by Singapore, Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar. And the answer is Thailand. So they would ask you questions like that. Looking in this region of Africa, what are the countries that are all east of this area? Whatever. I was really good at that. And I have, a pretty photographic memory. But then it became about placemaking online because as I was growing up, AOL chats were a huge part of my formation as a young queer person. Sure. And that's so much about place because the chat rooms were, you know, Tennessee gay, Middle Tennessee chat, or Tennessee Nashville chat. And so they're about the digital world very early on became about placemaking. So that because it was so vast, you needed these cartographic kind of cardinal spots to place you. So anyway, so that's where it all began. And I had all these fake online boyfriends and I would create like stories about myself because I wasn't out. So it just became this like kind of romance of writing about myself online. And that all intersected when Grindr launched into a career writing about it. And then I eventually worked at Grindr too. So it's okay.
I love this. I cut you off. So then you went to Grindr and then you were going to go do a whole new pivot about your next part of your career. But I was too curious about geography.
No, it's okay. So anyway, so beginnings, geography. I was writing about Grindr. I was writing about love online. My very first column was at the Chicago Tribune, and I was literally hired to be the Carrie Bradshaw for Chicago, but gay. I will never forget my editor asking me to do that. And that became so much about like place and all these things. And then eventually I became an investigative reporter at The Guardian, which was very much motivated by the Black Lives Matter movement erupting and being entangled in it without realizing. Like all my friends were the people that went to Ferguson, and I didn't go to Ferguson. I wrote about it from Chicago, and then, you know, all of our lives changed that summer, at that time in 2013. And then from there, my life just kept going down this journalistic path. It kept getting further and further away from geography. And then I wound up at Grindr because they said, could you build us a magazine using our geography technology? And then that's where I was at. So for years, I was working in media, news. And then in the pandemic, I pivoted to producing, and I helped make a musical on Broadway. And that's where the Tony in my like bio comes from, which is the most random thing because I never wanted to be a theater producer. And now I do a lot of theater producing. So it's a big
Well, I was a theater major, so having a Tony Award is like a huge fucking deal to me. You're the second Tony Award winner on this podcast, to my knowledge.
Oh my God.
Yeah, because we had Ali Stroker on, who won a Tony for Best Supporting Actress in a Musical. She and I went to NYU together. And
She's amazing.
I know Michael Jackson.
Yeah, there we go. Yes, you do.
I choreographed Michael's musical Only Children in college that has Tony Award winner Brandon Uranowitz in it and like all of these fantastic people. So I know and love A Strange Loop. Michael was working on A Strange Loop when we were doing Only Children. Like, I remember him being like, it's a show about Usher, who's an Usher, because his name's Michael Jackson. And so he, you know, anyways. So while the Tony Award might be the most random thing to you, it is probably the most important thing to me about you.
That's, thank you.
Your arbitrary award.
And it's so, and what's so funny, and maybe we can talk about this, is like, I love theater growing up so much, but theater, similar to like my place in Tennessee, my place in literature, my place in journalism, I never saw myself in any of these things in like a big way. So I didn't think it was all possible for me. So I never leaned in. And then I was dragged into certain things, like journalism wasn't a full choice. It was a door that opened and I said, what's behind this door? And then it became a thing. Theater also became that too. And it's really amazing because I get to meet people like you who are like, no, no, girl, we exist here. We have been here for a long time. It's not a new thing. So
I love it. It's so interesting hearing you talk about like your career and like being dragged into it because you were the editor in chief at The Advocate.
Mm-hmm. I was. Yeah.
If you didn't get dragged in the direction of journalism, mm-hmm. and I guess theater, but what do you think you would be doing? Like, what is the thing that you, what, like, I know you said you maybe wanted to be a geography professor, but do you think that's what you would have done? Or do you think that there's somewhere else you could see yourself in a parallel universe?
Oh my God. That's such a good question. I think, you know, there's a version of me that, you know, went to grad school, will finish. I started and then didn't finish. And, but there's a part of me that is now would be talking to you as a geographer at some university, hopefully, you know, trying to get on a tenure track, writing essays, trying to publish stuff. And that feels very real to me because there are many academics in my family. My mom is a neuroscience researcher. My stepdad's, you know, a psychologist. It's just like, there's just, my uncle is an optometrist, but did research at Vanderbilt. And a lot of my family worked at Vanderbilt. So I just grew up around a lot of academics. So academia always felt like very accessible in many ways to me, especially seeing my mom go back to school later in life and accomplish what she did and then enter. I was like, well, you know, my mom can do this. I can figure this out. But besides that, the dream jobs when I was growing up was I wanted to be a fashion designer. That was like that was the huge dream. I used to read all the time as a kid. Like I literally, there was a moment in my life where I tried to read a book a day. Like I was like my obsession. I was like, can I read a book a day? And it was like Steinbeck poetry. Like,
whoa, how old were you?
I was like 11, 12.
I thought you were going to be like, it was like a 5-page chapter book, a little like picture book. Steinbeck.
Like, yeah, I was like Steinbeck, Austin. I could read Jane Austen really fast. But I was obsessed with reading. And when I wasn't reading, I was reading books. I was reading fashion magazines. And when I wasn't reading fashion magazines, I was sketching outfits, specifically dresses. And I love the Style Network and the fashion channels. And I would just watch runway shows. And, you know, and that's where I think like geography has always been a huge part of my life is because I felt out of place where I lived. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I should be in New York. I felt like I should be in Paris. So there was always this tension of where I was and where I felt emotionally I should be. And the internet helped bridge that early on because I got to project myself into these places through, you know, .com. Back then, you know, I really wanted to be that. And then that became fashion, became food. And I literally, there was like, when I was 18, I literally was working in food. I did a competition called the Top Teen Chef competition where I flew to Chicago and I competed on camera for a scholarship.
God, you have so many talents.
I know. It's like somebody, it's just, I'm just really gay. I like no clothing. I know food. I know literature. Like, it's like, I'm just gay. I hate to listen to that, but I thought I was going to work in food for a while and then it all kind of stopped. But I think through all of that, writing was always so important because even when I was working on food, I was like, I want to write a cookbook. And I was working on one with my grandmother that was about recipes passed through our family. And I was like 18. So story, when I hit my 20s, was always central to everything I did. And that's why, you know, I work in theater now because it's story based as well.
It's so interesting. Like, I'm listening to you talk about all these things you're interested in. And like, I think because you started with geography, I'm just hearing about how all of these things are really place-based and story-based. It's like you were into geography because you were interested in like the relationship of people to places. And then fashion is like totally a place-based art. Yeah. And food is such a place-based thing. And I just, it's so interesting hearing you talk about that because when I was like researching you and like preparing and I saw your job at Grindr, I was like, that's such a weird random job. But now I'm like, oh my God, that's the job that makes more sense than any job he's ever had. Like,
it does.
It just like totally clicks in my brain. And another thing, and this is what Sam Sanders always says about you, and I experienced when I emailed you to come on the show. He always says you're such a connector. He's like, Zach is the connector. He's like capital C, always connecting people. And when I emailed you, I was like, hey, Zach, I don't know if you remember, but we met at this party. I'd love to have you come on. And you were like, yes, of course I remember. It was so great. We talked about you on the podcast today. Also, I always see you on Shane's page, blah, blah, blah. And Shane's one of my really good friends. And I literally thought to myself, I was like, he is such a connector because he took all of the little pieces that we have in common and connected them and like put them out for me. And I'm just like, I guess the question is there is like, what is the connecting piece to you that's important? Or like, why do you think that you always strive to do that? And I'm sure there's some geography, something in there. But like, what is, like, how do you be, how do you become a connector?
I think connection has everything to do with being seen and being authentically seen. I like to think that I have a ability that is probably special in that, like, I've really tried to hone it over years of, you know, paying witness or creating space to be a witness to people's lives and really taking that as truth. Like when someone tells me something, and that's what got me into journalism. I believe so much in truth telling. I was like, how you're talking about, you know, your experience as a Black trans woman trying to survive in sex work, which is like stuff I used to write about a lot. Like that is truth. And that should be the beginning of this conversation. And I think a lot of times when people have conversations with each other, they're really, you know, playing this game of like, I want you to ask me a question. I want to tell you something about myself.
Yeah.
And I, due to my own, you know, trauma, upbringing, whatever, I grew up around a lot of people who didn't ask me a lot of questions. So I always felt like not very seen. And I felt as a Black person in a very, you know, white space and a queer person in a very straight space, you know, not seen, but stereotyped a lot. So I felt this tension in my life all the time. So whenever... what I learned to do to get through that is to find people that did see me and then also accepted me. And from there, I saw this power in myself because I saw how more confident I became when someone gave me space to be myself or someone gave me space to share my story and said, that's true, I believe you, that I wanted to, you know, reflect that back. So whenever I'm connecting people, and this happens so much, it's my attempts in real time to tell the other person, not only do I see you, but I want you to be other people that remind me of you, that you should know, that you should be in community with, that I think you guys could do something great together. And that's where just the fuel for it comes, because it's so annoying because Sam does bring it up all the time, but it's annoying because how true it is. And I didn't have the language. I didn't think of myself as a connector before. I always thought of myself as like there's Zach, just busybody, knows too many people, and it's just passing people off. But I do think there's like an art to bringing people together. And there's even a book that I've been reading that's called The Art of Gathering. It's actually right in front of me.
That's like one of my favorite books. She did the show. Priya Parker. She did? Genius.
Oh my God. But yeah, so
I've read it like three times. I love it so much.
So that's like my shit. Like that is me. Like it's like intentionality. Why are we together? Why are we sharing space? What do we do with this energy that we're pulling from each other? And so that's where it just comes from. And I get like so much joy. And I think out of everything I've done in my life, it's always like it's story driven, but it's also connection driven. Because, you know, being an editor in chief was really about putting pieces together. It was someone pitching me, I want to do a story on the border of the US, Mexico, and Tijuana. Okay, great. How are you getting there? Who's going to be a photographer? Who's going to edit this? Who's going to shoot the photos? When are we going to release it? Who's the audience for this? It was all about like putting together these packages and then delivering it to the world. And and that's where the connection part comes from. And I love it. And I will always be this way till I die, I'm sure.
I am a connector. I don't know if I'm quite as a connector as you. I don't think I know as many people as you, but you're speaking my language, because I do love to be like, oh, I know a person who you should talk to about that, or like, oh, like I just, and I don't know why I do it. I think it's just because I am a busybody.
It's a great funnel for anxiety. If you're an anxious person, you can then, and then you're also, you do become, the dark side of this is you become beloved quickly by helping someone, by saying, hey, I got someone for you. And then they're like, oh my God, you're amazing. You helped me with something. And you're like, yeah, thank you. Now you don't hate me, which is my biggest fear in life, is that you're going to hate me.
Well, I'm scared that people are going to hate me, but I also have come to terms with the fact that people hate me. Like, I'm pretty hateable, I understand. Like, either you love me or you really don't like me. And I finally, like, come to terms with that. For me, like, when you can, like, or like when you have, like, a dinner party and you get the right group of people together, and I'm like, oh, I'll, like, after everyone leaves, I'll turn to my husband and be like, I fucking nailed the guest list on this one.
Like, I'm like, wow, we are kindred. Like, that is fully, yes. A big judge for me is, and if friends are listening to this when this comes out, they're going to laugh, because I was in Chicago the other day and we sat at a table and a very dear friend's boyfriend asked, how does everyone know each other? And everyone was like, Zach. And it was over like a decade. Everyone was like, Zach is literally the linchpin. But what I love about that is that I was the beginning, but I'm not the end. These people become better friends. They have a deeper, more soulful connection than I have with them. Even my own partner sometimes has better relationships with people I've known for a decade than I do. And I take so much joy in that, because I'm like, oh, then I was a bridge. You two should know each other. Like, I don't need to have the best relationship with everybody, but I think everyone deserves a best friend. And I would love to set people up.
Oh, I love that so much. That's so funny. My best friend, her partner, we all knew each other growing up in high school or whatever, and I became friends with him better in college, and then they started dating like a few years ago, and when people ask them how they know each other, she tells the true story, but he says it's through me, and I'm like, it's not through me, but I love that you think that it's through me. Like, I'm like, actually, this is how you guys met, blah, blah, blah. Like, because I have one of those memories where I remember every detail, and every time he says it, I'm like, it's not true, but like, it's fine. I'll take it.
And you have to let, I mean, Tracy, you're saying something important. Sometimes how people remember stories, or to quote Joan Didion, we tell ourselves stories to stay alive. Like, don't challenge someone's story. Like, let them just have it if it doesn't really rock the boat too much.
Yeah, it makes me feel good. It makes you feel right. Yep. It's fine. Okay. I want to know, well, I guess you sort of talked about this a little bit, but what I really liked about you the first time we met, and just talking to you now and listening to you on the podcast, is I feel like you're like a very fun person. You seem like a very good hang, like we could have a good time. But then I look at like all your bylines and I look at your body of work and I'm like, Zach is a very serious journalist. Like, Zach is like covered, like you wrote a piece on O'Shea Sibley. Like, you're writing about serious shit in American life, Black life, queer life, the intersection of those things. Is it ever hard for you to square Zach, the person, with Zach, the byline journalist guy?
Oh my God. It used to be such an issue. So I feel like today, in the past few years, I don't write as much. Like, now I'll do like a piece or two a year. So the past few years, it's been, you know, the New York Times had me do a feature in the real estate section about Fire Island and issues in Fire Island, which, to your point, was like, I meet this fun, loving guy that people probably have met in Fire Island. Yeah. Then I write this like definitive piece in the Times about how racism and housing are in crisis there.
And geography, Fire and geography, Island, location.
It's about place, yeah, it's about location, yes. Yes, it's just. And then like even O'Shea Sibley, you know, I'm a huge Beyonce fan and went to so many of her shows, but then someone gets murdered in New York City. And I write about it and very quickly because I just had to like jump to it because it felt very authentic to me. And that was also about place because O'Shea was murdered miles away from her as she was performing. And for me, it was like such a tragedy of place and who can be in place, like a show like Beyonce's, and then who can't and what happens when you're not in that place. So when I was younger, though, at the height of my really serious investigative journalism. And I used to be at The Guardian. That was for like 3 years. And I was an opinion columnist at first. Just being a columnist is super fun because I just write my opinion and you create all these like wars online. And it used to be really fun to be on Twitter and that was great. Then I moved into really hard news and doing things around, you know, murders, police brutality, traveling. I would be on murders. It was really heavy. And like people who knew me back then just saw the tension building of I'm so happy-go-lucky, but like the work was really draining me. And I'd be at these dinner parties and people would be like, what do you do? And I'd be like, well, today I was at a prison and this thing. And it was just like so contradictory to how I present it. And so it was really complicated for me. And I felt really like I didn't feel like a real journalist because I was really nice. I felt like a fake journalist because when I had like a young person, if I was doing a story, like I remember doing a story in Kansas City about this young man named Deontay Green, and I was 25, I think at the time, and he was murdered, and I was with his mom, and I was sitting in her bed, and we were talking about it, and I just like held her hand, and I remember being like, I'm not a real journalist because I'm holding her hand, but I was like, I am a real journalist because I'm actually bearing witness to this. So it just felt like this constant back and forth, and I was a bit too me in everything. And I think that's what I've just accepted these days where, you know, we're all complicated. I can be super fun, make a borderline inappropriate joke, but also let there be a very serious thing arise, and I can rise to meet the occasion. It's kind of like I used to, when I was at Grindr, I used to tell our newsroom all the time when they'd be like, well, why are we doing? Because when I was at Grindr, we launched a magazine that was really journalistically, I think, really amazing. Like we did things that other queer magazines weren't doing. And that's why I eventually went to The Advocate. And people would say, like, why does Grindr do news? And I would be like, well, similar to Playboy. Playboy, once upon a time, did real news. Right. They had a correspondent in the White House that would do reporting from there. And I think we as people are complicated. You can be horny and also want to read something and like vice versa and on and on. So I think like, you know, I've just learned to hold all those multitudes of myself and not make myself feel bad about it because I'm very conscious of people meet me and they're probably like, this is probably a PR gay or a marketing gay because I'm so happy. Then they're like, oh, wow. He's like, I've like literally moderated a presidential debate in the 2020 race. And it's like, oh, no, he's like gone like head to head with like our now presidents or people who've run for president. So it's kind of, it's fun. I like it. It's like it's a very queer life.
I love it because I feel like you are like, you're someone that I trust because I feel like I know you're going to do a good job, but also I know you're not going to be like too hoity-toity or like, no. I'm not going to like, I know that you're accessible to me. And I feel like that's probably why a lot of people like you and like your work is it's like, you're going to get the hard-hitting news, but you're going to get it in a way that like meets you where you are.
Yeah.
And I just really appreciate that about your work. And like, also when you guys talk on Vibe Check, like that's like my favorite thing about the show is you guys give real serious, you know, consideration to these issues, but you do it in a way that I'm like, these are my friends.
Yeah. It's like, because like you're, I think it gives weight to your humanity that you're a person moving through the world that watches horrible news all day, sees the market zipping, imagines the most awful futures for your children and family. But you also like want to laugh.
But you also like the new Jack Harlow.
But you like the new Jack Harlow. Like you contain all of this at once. And I think I got tired of being in the machine. And Sam went through this machine too of, you know, the formal journalism training of you got to talk a certain way, be a certain way. When I was like, it doesn't have to be delivered this way. We can like literally kiki and I can tell you the world's ending. The world's still going to end. Like it doesn't matter how I deliver.
Well, that's how this show came to be is like, I want to talk about books, but I don't want to be the fucking New Yorker. Like
Exactly. Like it just like... Yeah. Yeah. It just, the air gets so thin when you're up there, and it just is not, it's not fun. And it's, I mean, it's why I stopped doing academia, because I remember so clearly, I published my first academic article. It was called The Power of the Queer Queen. It was a super queer theory, jargon heavy, bullshit type of writing thing that I used to do. Right. And my mom, who's brilliant, one of the smartest people I know, read it. And she said to me, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I thought, is that my future, writing things that my mother won't even understand? Right. And I took that article and published a piece on Thought Catalog when that was a thing, called The Five Men You Meet on Grindr. And that was my first blog. And I took all that theory and brought it into practice in an accessible way. And I think, like, that's why I love your show. And I love so many other shows that our friends do. Because, like, how do we take literature? How do we take theory? How do we take news and make people feel comfortable engaging with it? And, yeah, and that's what we need more of.
Ugh, I love it. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back. When I started podcasting, an online store was truly the furthest thing from my mind. Now I'm selling super cute sweatshirts, tote bags, other bookish swag, and it's so easy. All because I use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit $1 million order stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, they have you covered. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system for wherever or whatever you're selling. If you came to the Stax tour and bought merch, that was the in-person POS system. I'm just telling you, I use it. I love it. Turn your casual browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It is 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. In case you don't know, I was an emotional mess when I first saw the Stax merchandise on a listener while out in public. After starting this podcast and building a community, I had to be talked into creating merchandise, and Shopify made it possible. There is a 0% chance I would have merch if Shopify wasn't so easy to use. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/thestax, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/thestax now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/thestax. Okay, y'all, this past week, I threw a party in LA to celebrate the LA Times Book Festival and just generally bookish people all around. And it was the best time. I'm sure you've seen the pictures on Instagram, but I have to say a huge thank you to Lit Cocktails for helping make this party a total blast. Lit Cocktails is a mobile bartending company that provides a fun, personable, unique, yet professional experience for clients who want more than your average boring black tie bartenders. They're here for weddings, birthday parties, corporate events, or any other reason you might need to celebrate with a cocktail. Lit Cocktails is owned and operated by Diamond Davis, a Black LGBTQ woman who started the company after losing her job as a restaurant manager during the 2020 pandemic. Diamond has created more than just a service. It is truly an experience, and it celebrates diversity, love, and community. I could feel that from the bar the entire evening. Diamond was a joy to have. She made the best drinks, always had a smile on her face, and honestly became one of my new favorite people. Lit Cocktail packages include ice, garnishes, cups, napkins, straws, a customized menu, two specialty cocktails, non-alcoholic beverages and mixers, 1 free hour of setup and breakdown, and an alcohol shopping list. Literally, you don't need to do anything but hire Diamond. She takes care of the rest. They also offer tastings for an additional fee, where they customize 8 to 10 drinks based on your flavor profile, and they'll even bring them to your home for you to sample. Go book a free consultation today by visiting www.litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram. Again, that's litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we are back with our segment called Ask the Stacks, where somebody writes in, they send an email to askthestacks@thestackspodcast.com, and they tell us what they're looking for in a book. And normally I prepare, but today I completely forgot. So I just read this question for the first time right before we started, and I have not put my predictions down or my suggestions down. So we'll do it together. We each have to give like one. I'll give three. You'll give one to three, whatever you want.
Okay.
And it's a really short one. It comes from Mary, and Mary said, I would love some recommendations for narrative nonfiction written by women.
Narrative nonfiction written by women.
Yeah.
Narrative, so is that memoir contained?
I don't consider narrative nonfiction memoir, though okay. Some people do. I consider narrative nonfiction like nonfiction that has like a story, but maybe isn't like history.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes true crime can fall in that category. Mm-hmm. Like, did you read like Empire of Pain by Patrick Radden-Keefe? Like a book
I
like that?
But I know what you're talking about.
Like that kind of book. That's like what I think of as narrative nonfiction. There is an argument to be made that memoir is narrative nonfiction. I think like memoir plus, when it's like a memoir, but they're talking about a bigger thing, I would consider that narrative nonfiction. But the categories in literature are so vague because they're really just for marketing. Do you know what I mean? So it's like,
yes,
whatever
yes.
this marketing person at Penguin Random House decides is whatever, that's what it
that's
is.
That's what's going to happen.
I can go first if you want. I'm trying to think.
Yes, I would love that because I'm going to make sure that the book I'm thinking of is nonfiction.
Okay. So the first one that comes to my mind is the book that I'm currently reading. I have not finished this, so Mary, it might suck, but I'm into it so far. It's called Trail of the Lost by Andrea Lankford. And Andrea is a former park ranger, and she is following three lost hikers on the Pacific Crest Trail, which is the same hike that Cheryl Strayed did. And they all disappeared. And she was a recovery park ranger, like in all these different parks. And she said, you know, she's never had cases where the bodies were never found if they died. And she's like, in these three cases, in a few months, they never found any of these guys. And so she's like following their trail. She's trying to figure out what happened. She's telling you about parks. She's sort of giving you this bigger picture of the Pacific Crest Trail, but also going in on these three guys. So that's my first recommendation. My second recommendation is my favorite book of 2023, which was We Were Once a Family by Roxana Azgarian, which is the story of the Hart family murders, which is phenomenal. And I've talked about it at length, and Roxana was on the show. But it's about the two white women who adopted the six black children and then drove them off the cliff. And she digs into the book, and she really gives you like a tender and loving look at the children and also their birth families. And then she also explains to you about family separation, specifically in Texas, but also more broadly in the country and how these systems work. It's just a phenomenal book. And then the last one I'm going to give you is the other book I'm reading right now. I love narrative nonfiction. What can I say? It's called Punished for Dreaming by Bettina Love. And the subtitle is How School Reforms Harm Black Children and How We Heal. And so she's talking about charter schools. She's talking about reform schools. She's talking about the ways that children, black children, have been treated in school systems. And she uses her own story, and she starts sort of with like Brown versus Board and how that took black teachers out of schools. And she brings it all the way up through the present, and she names names. She's like, Ronald Reagan, this motherfucker. And then she's like telling you each person who fucked up, who did stuff that harms kids. She talks about like the way that athletics are kind of lorded over children, and they're like, oh, you're here just to play sports, so you need to take these easy classes. And it's just this really powerful sort of scathing book, and I'm really liking it. Okay.
You are so good at this.
I do it every day.
I'm just like, as I'm going through everything, I'm like, that's a memoir. That's a memoir. That's
it's okay. Give a memoir. Give a. You can
I was
definitely
like, I was like, what can I pull from Joan Didion? Because she's such a reporter of a person, but it's like essays that are guiding you through American life. So that doesn't feel like a narrative that's taking us through the whole thing. What is something?
If there's a memoir you love, though, I feel like that can fit. A lot of people consider memoir narrative nonfiction.
Yeah. Oh, I think this works. Okay. I'm going to say it works.
Yeah.
I want to pick Audre Lorde, The Cancer Journals, where she writes about fighting cancer, but cancer and how it impacts Black women and their experiences with the medical system and her own body and power. And I think she was living in the Caribbean at the time when she was writing this in St. Lucia, I think, if I remember right. But it's just a really stunning way in which you use a personal experience to tell this larger structural story of what Black women are experiencing.
That definitely counts.
Okay, there we go.
Mary, if you read any of these books, let us know what you think. And everyone else at home, email askthestacks@thestackspodcast.com so you can get your recommendations, because we're running low. So I need them. So send them to me. Okay, now we're going to talk about Zach's taste in books. We always start here. Oh, two books you love, one book you hate.
Okay, so two books I love. One would be Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin. It just feels like home in many ways, even though it has a tragic ending. I just love that book so much. And it was my introduction to James Baldwin, who, of course, you know, all of his work has profoundly shaped me. But I don't know, that was one of the first books where I was like, okay, this is gay and I love it. And it's about France and all these other things. And then another book that I'm going to put up there is Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen.
Oh.
It used to be like, now, I mean, out of everything I read today, not so much, but a book that has withstood the test of time for me and was a refuge as a young person was amazing. And I would read the book and then watch the BBC miniseries all the time as a kid. And I was just, again, very gay. So those are the two I love. The one that I hate was surprising that I remember today. And I chose it because I did feel this huge amount of anger when I remembered it. But it's the book The Art of the Deal by Donald Trump.
Oh.
And why I dislike that book, beyond obviously his politics and things he's done and this circus that is him running again, is that it was the only book my dad, I think, ever read really in his life. My dad's not a big reader.
Got it.
And my dad is a Black man from the South and just found so much inspiration from a book that I was like, even at a young age when he made me read it when I was a teenager, I was like, this isn't for us. Like, we're not the same type of man as this man who says things like, dream big to go big, take risks, listen to your gut. Like, the advice is, like, not very amazing. It's just, like, if you're really rich and have connections, do whatever the fuck you want. Right. So I just really resented that book, and I've always resented that my father admired that book so much, because it felt like that was the fuel that led us to, you know, him becoming president was – people really love that book for some reason. And I hate that book.
I love this answer. I think you're the first person to say this book on the show.
Oh, great.
I love it. What kind of reader are you now as an adult?
I wish I read more. I used to read so, so much. Now it feels like it's for work, which I don't love. Like, I do miss the days in which I wasn't paid to talk to people about their books or write about their books because it used to be less stressful. Because now I think I read differently when I'm going through a book if I'm about to be in a conversation with somebody. But what I really love, just because I grew up, you know, on the internet and being friends with so many writers that have become huge players, like Asai Jones, like Roxane Gay, all these people I remember when I was like 21 emailing with them about things. Is that I can look, when I walk into bookstores now, and I also was an editor for so many years, so I know so many writers. I walk into bookstores and I know so many people who are publishing, and it makes me so hyped because I get to read their memoirs, their essay collections, their fiction. So I really like love my friends' work or people I've read online who've now created a work that's gone bigger. So that's where my reading goes, is that like I see a friend publishing, I'm going to read the book.
I love that. What's the last really great book you've read?
The last really great book I read, I would say In the Wake by Christina Sharp, which I talk a lot about on Vibe Check. It just really has impacted me in a way that I hadn't felt in a while. It reminded me of being 19 in college again, of reading Judith Butler or Bell Hooks for the first time.
Yeah.
And just being overwhelmed with how someone make so much sense of my own body in the world. Yeah. So that book is really, and it's the one I keep, you know, offering to people, sending to people, begging people to read.
I still haven't read it.
Oh, it's so good. You have to
I haven't read it. So, I know. I read the new one, Ordinary Notes.
Yes.
And it's really good. Have you read that one too?
I've started it. I've not finished that one yet. But Saeed got me on that one because I was like, in the wake. He's like, girl, there's a whole new book. Yeah. Like, oh.
Where you been?
I was like, sorry, I missed that.
What are you reading right now? And do you read multiple books at a time?
I completely read multiple books at one time. It's a problem because I'll carry a book in my backpack at all times. And then I'll buy something or get something else. Right now, I am reading The Art of Gathering. That's literally what I'm reading is usually sitting right in front of me. And that's what's right in front of me. Okay. By Priya Parker. And I'm also... I feel like I'm like, breaking news potentially, but I'm reading Erasure by...
You're not breaking news. People will know that that's our book club pick for this month when they hear this. But yes, okay, Erasure by Percival Everett. And you've seen the movie.
I've seen the movie first, which I kind of sometimes love. I love seeing sometimes a movie before the book. And I've seen the movie. I've known Cord Jefferson for a long time now, the director and writer. And it's a really phenomenal movie that is going to most likely be up for Best Picture at the Oscars, which is very exciting. Yeah.
So you saw it first and then you're reading it. I'm going to read it first and then see the movie. So I got to read it soon so that I can see it before we talk so that we can have the...
Yeah, the combo.
You know, the conversation. Who do you turn to pick a book? Do you go on the internet? Do you go to a book review? Are there friends that you trust? Like, how do you decide what to read next?
I mean, I go to Saeed Jones a lot of things. He reads so much. He's so always reading, always looking. So I go to him. I listen for friends of mine on their podcasts or shows that I listen to bring up a book that's coming out. Or I get pitched a lot of books too. So, you know, whenever that comes in, I do read these kind of excerpts and that guides me, which sometimes isn't the best way because that's a publicist pushing you. But it's really like through my personal network of friends. Like friends, whenever a friend tells me they're reading something, I take that as a big deal because I feel like people don't read very much anymore. So if someone's like, I'm obsessed with this book, then I will probably buy the book immediately and then try to read it eventually.
Can you think of any book that you've really loved that someone recommended to you that wasn't Saeed Jones?
Yes. My friend Marcus, who... surprised me with this one, recommended and sent me the book. It's called The Science of Storytelling, Why Stories Make Us Human and How to Tell Them Better. And it's a scientific approach to storytelling. And it talks about how the brain actually loves repetition and story and how story actually fuels our own sense of the world around us from like a brain level. And my mom is a neuroscientist. So like brain, anything that I can find to be a bridge between her and my stepdad is great. And this book became that for me. And it just is a really beautifully accessible scientific way of thinking of story.
I love that. Okay, what's a book that you like to recommend to other people?
What's a book I like to recommend to other people? I recommend this book a lot and I feel bad because it's really annoying, I think, at some level, but it's this book called Cruising Utopia by Jose Esteban Munoz. He's a queer theorist. He died, I think, a decade ago. He's at NYU, but it's about, it's kind of the canonical text today of where queer theory is at. And he uses popular media to talk about it. People like Kevin Aviance, who was the person in Beyonce's new album that she pulled from to create those beats. He's writing about a lot of that music that she's inspired by to talk about what it means to be queer today. But it's a book I've given to so many queer friends of mine, academics. There was even a moment where I gave it to a painter and he created an entire series based off this and then did a portrait of me, which was very weird. I'd never given someone a book and then they created a whole series of paintings.
So it was a very
impactful book. But it kind of has this, for me, it has this one note in it that I always think about. And it says, queerness is not here yet. And it's about being queer in America, queer in the world, is kind of like looking at a North Star. Like it's always a place that you're looking to, but you'll never get there. And it's always changing and moving. And it gave me a lot of comfort because it always felt, when I first got the book, that being queer felt very stagnant, felt like it was a box you checked and then it was over. And it didn't feel that way. But right. It was academically how people were talking about it. You come out of the closet, you identify as gay. But I was like, I feel like my identity is always shifting and changing. And his book allows you to see that from like a really beautiful, like theoretical lens with some really great writing in there too.
I love that. Okay, I'm hearing you talk about a lot of nonfiction, but your two favorite books were novels, or the two books you loved were novels. So I'm wondering, what's your relationship to reading fiction versus nonfiction?
It's fiction for me feels like a nice vacation for my brain. Like it's okay. Like a way in which I can like, I feel like I read fiction like by the beach where I'm like Got diving it. Into a book that that helps me go to another world. I think just being a journalist, I find myself so drawn to nonfiction and it helps me. I apply it to so many things in my life. I'm not saying fiction doesn't, but I feel like I love documentaries a lot.
Yeah.
I love unscripted television a lot. I love people so much that I like seeing them animated in their real lives. But fiction is a place that I need to like work on, similar to working on like scripted projects or whatever. Right. I mean, Strangely Biz scripted, obviously, right. But like that was the first big scripted thing I did where I was right. Like, but it felt nonfiction to me. It felt like, my
right, because it was
ways.
Like auto-fiction.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm a big nonfiction person, and I do read fiction, but not a ton. And I also am just really drawn to like true life stories. So I totally relate. What's your ideal reading setup? Where are you? Are there snacks and beverages? Time of day? Temperature? Any of those kind of things?
I've learned that I can't read with music that has words. So okay. I like a vibe. Like I like okay. like a lo-fi playlist. Yeah, yeah. It's just like can be any hotel bar in any part of the world. I love reading by a pool a lot. Okay. Like I spent a lot of the summer in California finding pools or outdoor spaces to read and lay out. So I really enjoy that. I don't love reading when I'm going to bed. I know that's a very popular thing for people to do because yeah. I get so inspired and my brain just turns back on and I can't go to sleep. So I need to like zone out. But yeah, outside, nice music.
Snacks and beverages?
Oh, a glass of wine would be great. A cocktail. Yeah. I'm into that. Yeah.
I love the daydream. Yeah. Do you have a favorite bookstore?
Yes. And actually went there the other day. Women and Children First in Chicago.
Oh, in Chicago. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
It's, yeah.
That's amazing. And what's the last book you bought? Do you remember?
The last book I bought. I think it was Erasure. Erasure was the last book I bought, technically. Yeah.
I think me too, actually. Yeah. what's the last book that made you laugh?
The Britney Spears memoir.
Did you love it?
I was so into it.
I was so into it.
I think I can say this much because this won't reveal anything. I know the ghostwriter of it. I know the person that wrote it with her. There was a team. And he and I have been friends for a long time. So, and he did not disclose anything. So if Britney Spears' people are listening, he did not break his NDA. But reading it and listening to the audiobook was so cool to be like, I know the person that like worked with her on shaping this and to hear her tell the truth and need people to like help bring that truth out. I was obsessed with all the name dropping that like Ryan Gosling just appears out of nowhere as a kid. Yeah. Like the Justin Timberlake truth bombs, like all of that just really like was so amazing. But just her like how she talks about her life so casually just made me laugh. I was like, this is ridiculous.
Wait, is her ghostwriter secret? Because I know who her ghostwriter is too.
I don't know. That's why I can't
never public.
Is it? I hope.
My friend Chelsea Devantes does that Celebrity Book Club pod, or now it's called Glamorous Trash, and she said his name on her show.
Yes. No, it is public. Sam Lansky.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. I was like, I know who it is, but I wasn't sure. Okay. Yeah.
I was like, am I spilling tea? Yeah, it's in the New York Times. Screw it. We can talk about it. Sam Lansky.
Yeah. Sam Lansky. I thought he did a great job. I thought the book was so good. I read it like the day it came out. In that one day on the audio or whatever, and I was like, oh my God, you guys, this is so good. And so many people were like, really? And I was like, yes,
yeah,
like,
it's really pretty, it's pretty,
pretty incredible. And I love celebrity memoir as a genre. Like, I read probably like 5 to 10 a year, and this one was by far my favorite of this year. It's just like, also, it was so short. Like, if you give me a 5-hour audiobook, chances are I'm gonna love it. Like, 1,000%. I don't want, I don't, Prince Harry. I read it, but 24 hours is too many hours for me. That's 20 too many hours, okay? Like Jada Pinkett.
I forgot it was that
15
long.
15 hours for Jada Pinkett.
Is it Barbara Streisand's 48 hours?
Yes, hers is 1,000 pages. But at least with Barbara Streisand, well, I'm not going to read it. At least I'm like, you've been famous for so long.
Yeah.
With Jada Pinkett Smith, I'm like, boo-boo, honey, no.
And also, what do we not know already that you put in here?
Everything.
Like, this is
everything.
This is, yeah. No, I don't.
That's the last book that made me want to, like, actually commit a violent act against a human. Not her, but just I wanted to go out into the street and, like, push a stranger. Like, I was just like, I hate it. What's the last book that made you cry?
Last book? I think, I don't cry, but I think I'm like a big non-cry, which is weird. It's like once in a blue moon.
So I don't really cry either.
It's just, yeah, not there. But the Britney Spears memoir was really, it's heartbreaking. You know, getting all the confirmation of how rough everything was for her and how we participate in how terrible it was without realizing. Yeah. That was really hard. So yeah, that was the recent one. That really was gut punch.
Yeah. What's the last book that made you angry?
I mean, it keeps saying Britney Spears.
Britney Spears. I know. It has the range.
It just has the range because you're just, I mean, it's just what I love about celebrity memoir lately is that we're getting memoirs of people that I feel like I grew up with and I now care more about. When I was young, a lot of the memoirs that were coming out about old Hollywood, I didn't have that personal connection to.
Totally.
But now when Mariah Carey releases her book, which has the best audiobook of all time.
That was our first book club pick of 2023, our January book club pick.
Incredible.
So good.
But when you're listening to that, you can also place yourself within her story. Like I was a mixed kid growing up in the 90s. She was coming to fame in the 90s, early 90s, late 80s. And it's like you just see yourself woven into it. So celebrity memoirs, everything. And I found myself emotionally responding to those memoirs because they're just becoming more truthful these days. And
like Serena Williams has one coming out allegedly this year or next year.
Oh, cool.
And I cannot wait.
That's
the one I'm like, it's, I mean, hopefully if it's a letdown, I'm going to feel so sad, but like, I believe in her.
I think it's really great.
Where's a book that you read that you felt like you really learned a lot, or the last book you felt like you learned a lot?
The last book I felt like I learned a lot. I mean, Christina Sharp, I feel like I was learning a lot really quickly. The first, I'm trying to think, I read this book and I actually like love the author so much. His name is Adolphe Acoporo. He wrote this book called Asylum. And it's about his immigration process to the States and his journey of being outed in Nigeria and coming here. And I had done so much reporting on, you know, immigrant experiences, and I've been to detention center, like all this stuff. But I'd never read from someone firsthand. And it just really, like, changed my life in many ways, and thinking about, you know, ICE and America and Trump and his damage he's done to people. Cause sometimes I feel like he's impacted my life, of course, in so many ways, but I'm not the lowest rung on the ladder. And Adolphe was, and to see what happened post Obama to him was just shocking to me. So it was Asylum.
That sounds really good. Just for people listening, I'm linking to everything he mentions in the show notes. You don't have to write these down. There's a whole list of every book, everything we talk about. Are there any books that you have not read that you're embarrassed about still having never read?
I'm going to go to the greats for this. Moby Dick. I have never read and have no interest. Yeah, I just don't care. It's just,
that's one of the most hated books that people say on the show.
Really?
So I'm like, I'm not going to read it. Too many people hate it for me. Like, it could be great, but it could also suck. And I can't.
It has bad vibes. I don't know. I don't want to read it. So it's like one of those books that, like, there's a series of books that you read when you're in high school or middle school, and it's one of them, and everyone makes it their personality if they think they're very, like, smart. Like, whatever. So there's that one. Yeah. Moby Dick.
Do you have any problematic favorite books?
Oh. Okay, yes. But it's a kind of a cheat. So they're journals, but that are a book. So Get Me Drunk, and I'll talk to you about this forever. I'm obsessed with the journals from Lewis and Clark, like Meriwether Lewis and Clark.
The explorers.
The explorers that are literally the reason for, like, colonialism on the west side of this country, which is why it's so problematic. It's like, this is like the guys that created the path through Indigenous territories and ushered in the Union soldiers to take out them and the Mexican government. So I'm obsessed with them. They're so fascinating. I'm so mad there's not a movie made of their exploration, because when you read the journals closely, it's very apparent to me, projecting a contemporary lens onto a past subject, that Meriwether Lewis is a homosexual and is in love with Clark deeply. And that the big reason why he goes west is that he's fired by... I think it's Jefferson or Jackson, one of those people. I'm not fact checking. Someone old and white from back then fires them. That was a president. He then is sent on this exploration, brings Clark because he really admires him. And on this trip, he is just deeply in love with this man and doing everything for him to fall in love with him. But this man is obviously in love with other people like Sacagawea and other folks they come across. And that Meriwether Lewis becomes really like gay in the most stereotypical ways. There's one moment where there's a hailstorm and they take cover and some soldiers are with them, and he decides to make cocktails afterwards with the ice that is the hail. And I'm just like obsessed. But he's just also awful to so many people, and he has a really tragic end that no one talks about, that he does die sadly by suicide at the end of his life. And so we like prop these two men up, but when they came back from that trip, like one of them was severely fucked over it. And I think it's heartbreak.
I have a few things to tell, to get on the record about this. First of all, obsessed with this take. Second of all, and people, this is how you know I'm sort of an idiot. I thought Lewis was a lady. I thought they were husband and wife. I thought it was Lewis and Clark. I don't know why, but I have done exactly zero reading about these people. There's like an era in American history that I truly do not care about. It's like the 1800s before the Civil War. Like that, like 1830 to like 1850 couldn't be less interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's where apparently Lewis and Mr. Clark, not to be confused with Mrs. Lewis and Mr. Clark, that might be where they're situated. But I sense that they were in love. I just thought they were a married couple.
Nope. And that maybe many people think that too. Like they romanticize heterosexuality so much that they're like, oh, they were obviously a couple going. Nope. Yes. Two single men who went on this together.
It's giving Brokeback.
It's very Explorers. It's the original Brokeback, and we need the movie. Immediately. I'm into it.
Well, produce it. Hello. You've got a Tony Award. Throw your weight around.
I know. Be like, let's do this thing. Because it just like, I mean, not to spoil the end, but they famously, when they hit Oregon, they took the trip backwards separate. So something happened at the end. They don't really know. And then they all separated. And when they came back, Lewis fell into deep depression, married, but his wife wrote a letter. Sorry, these journals are like, have so much going on. The wife wrote a letter and she's pretty much like, we never had sex and I divorced him. So she divorced him really fast. And then he sadly passed away. So it's like there's so much drama. And the end is like, not fulfilling. Like, it's not like this big, like, Love, Simon ending of a gay movie. It's not like they run off to sunset. Like, one of them goes to marry a woman, the other one dies, and that homophobia just blossoms in America. And the beginning of America's expansion was a tragic love story of a queer man and a straight man. I think it's just really fascinating.
Okay, you have sold the shit out of this. I cannot wait. We're all going to read it. Okay, if you were a high school teacher, what's a book you would assign to your students?
I would say Gender Outlaw by Judith Butler. I keep bringing up all this like academic stuff. I love it. Like, I love these. And I think just because I think that's the book where Judith Butler, the theorist, writes that gender is a performance. And when I was a teenager, I needed to hear that. When I did hear it the first time at like 18, where, you know, every day we wake up and make conscious choices. Like, I put on the shirt to signal something to you about my identity. Right. I put on these shoes, et cetera, et cetera. And that, like, you have a lot of control over how you move through the world. And that does back into all these systems like gender. So the book is fascinating beyond that. But that was the big takeaway for me, to be like, oh, all of this is constructed. This is all a social construct that we're living in. And I think if people understand that earlier on, they can maybe navigate it easier later in life.
I love it. Okay, last one. If you could require the current president of the United States to read one book, what would it be?
Read one book. Joe Biden. You could read one
that
book.
That fucking guy.
So my book I would give to our president currently is Light in Gaza, Writings Born of Fire, which was edited by a few authors, all Palestinian. Everyone in the book is Palestinian. But I think it gives, you know, a lot of humanity that's needed greatly in discussing this conflict on every side. But this book is one that isn't very well known that people should read and know.
I love it. I love it. Thanks, Zach. Of everyone. Course. Zach's going to be back on January 31st, the last day of this month in this brand new year. We're talking about the novel Erasure by Percival Everett. We will have spoilers, so be sure to read the book with us. Come back at the end of the month. You can find Zach all over the internet. I'll link to everything you talked about on the show notes. I'll link to the podcast. I'll link to his socials. Zach, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. This was just the highlight of my week. This has been lovely.
Yay. And we're recording this on a Friday. So that means I made all the way to the end. It's like if somebody says that on a Monday, it's like, okay, bitch, it's fucking Monday. How dare you? You
have been through some highs and lows and you won. So yeah, thank you.
And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you, of course, to Zach Stafford for being our guest. I'd also like to say a quick thank you to Chantel Holder for being our connector on today's episode. Remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for January is Percival Everett's novel Erasure, which we will discuss with Zach Stafford on Wednesday, January 31st. If you love this show and you want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed wherever you're listening to your podcasts. If you're listening through Apple Podcasts or Spotify, will you please leave us a rating and a review? For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.